This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, March 15th, 2017. This is the 135th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is the Executive Director of New York's one and only Food and Drink Museum, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be flexible. Be prepared to adapt to unexpected circumstances. As we know, life happens. Schedules change, weather changes. Yes, nothing is absolute. So get comfortable with the fact that things may not always go according to your master plan and be ready to go in a new direction. There's no need to stress, just practice flexibility and things will work out just fine. That's my tip today. Now, I'm happy to have my guest on the show. It is Peter Kim. He is the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, the world's first large-scale food museum with exhibits you can eat. In 2011, Peter began working with Dave Arnold on launching MOFAD to create a global center for education that shows people how exciting it is to learn and care about food. Since then, he has overseen all aspects of the project's development. He has been featured in the New York Times, the New Yorker, NPR, the Wall Street Journal, and more, and has spoken widely about the museum's dynamic approach. He is calling in today from Austin because he's at South by Southwest, so... Hello, Peter. Are you out there?
Hey, sorry. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. So I'm actually calling from El Paso because I just wrapped up at South by Southwest, and I strung on to this an event with another nonprofit out in El Paso with Dave. So Dave and I are out here right now.
Oh, awesome. Well, making the best of your trip out there. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to talk with you and hear more about MOFAD and what you do there. So I'd like to start out with my guess as how you got into the industry. So what brought you into the hospitality industry and led you to where you're at now?
Yeah, well, my first step into the hospitality industry was a crazy endeavor of trying to open a food museum. I actually have a pretty varied professional background. I worked in hunger policy, public health, arts education, and my last pre-MOFAD job was actually as a corporate lawyer. While I was working as an attorney, I went to culinary school on the weekends and ran the obligatory supper club out of my apartment and was contemplating moves into the industry, and that's when I got wind of this event that was happening at Del Posto, where there's a guy named Dave Arnold who was going to talk about this idea he had for opening a museum of food and drink, and there were going to be these chefs involved, like Dave Chang and Wiley Dufresne, Christina Tosi. And I went to this event and heard Dave talk about this idea he had for opening a museum of food and drink and was totally inspired. And so I reached out to him after that, just a blind email to, you know, the sort of generic MOFAD email address. And he responded enthusiastically, and I actually started working with Dave as his attorney. And it wasn't until later that I made the leap over to actually start leading the effort to build the museum.
Oh, wow. When was this about? Like, what year are we in?
It's March 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know, and for people listening, so Dave Arnold is part of Heritage Radio Network. He has an amazing show called Cooking Issues. And so we're big fans. I know, and we collaborate a lot with MOFAD and Heritage Radio Network, which is awesome. So I know Dave kind of had this idea before 2011. Like, what was, I mean, how, when you met him, was it at the at this dinner? Then was it ready to launch the brick and mortar part, or how did that go?
Oh, far from it. Far from it.
Okay.
You know, Dave is, Dave, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the listeners know Dave. You know, he defies adjectives in a lot of ways. I mean, he's a genius, and, you know, something of a food mad scientist. And, you know, he'd had this idea for opening a museum back actually in 2004 when he was still just a budding food writer and inventor. And he went to an exhibit on Vietnamese food and was really disappointed. He just thought it was, frankly, just, you know, rinky-dink. And so, you know, it just didn't really do justice to Vietnamese food culture. And, you know, it occurred to him at that point, well, why isn't there a museum, a world-class food museum, especially in New York City? And so he started exploring the idea, but then he got tapped then to start and run the Department of Culinary Technology at the French Culinary Institute. And so it kind of went to the back burner after that, and it wasn't until 2011 that he did this lunch, and really nothing had happened between the initial idea and this, and so he put this lunch together just to sort of announce the idea and get a little seed money to get things off the ground. When I emailed him actually right after the lunch at Del Posto, I figured they had everything figured out, and I didn't even really see what kind of role I could play to help them get it off the ground. But, you know, when I heard back from Dave, I told him to bring in all the information about the museum, what the plans were, you know, what the funding strategy was, so on and so forth. And there was really nothing. You know, he had a really this great idea, it's, you know, big vision, but hadn't really fleshed out the bones to it yet. And so I started, you know, just as his attorney to advise him on it. But then, you know, I realized over time that he actually needed, you know, somebody needed to step in and actually execute all this.
So what was your first execution, I guess I'd say, or like, where did you, I mean, how did you go about then creating this museum?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, opening a museum in New York City is challenging. You know, it's, you know, you're a nonprofit, and so you have to really get people to support out of the goodness of their heart. And it's inherently very capital intensive because you need a space and you need exhibits, you need things, you need stuff. And so, you know, when I first started doing research on how to get this off the ground, I realized that we needed to take a phased approach to this and do something that was more bite-sized. And so in 2013, I started as a director in May 2012, and it took about a year just to figure out up and down how museums get started, what the voice of MOFAD was, get the branding together, get the mission together, understand our curatorial approach. And then the following year, we launched our first Kickstarter. We realized that, you know, we're going to have to do this, get funding through grassroots funding strategies. And so we started with a Kickstarter, and we funded a mobile exhibition that was based around this one spectacular machine that we had acquired, which is a cereal puffing gun.
The puffing gun.
Yeah, yeah. Do you eat cereal, Shari?
Yes, I do.
what kind of cereal do you eat?
Oh, I don't know. I have a variety. I don't have a particular. I don't have a particular favorite, but I definitely eat cereal.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, cereal actually. There's a crazy story behind cereal. I won't get into it right now, but, you know, it started as a cure for masturbation, among other things, and with this religious cure. And in the 20th century, there was this shift to a mass-marketed product, and this machine, the puffing gun, was part of that. And it basically is this two-ton machine that heats up ingredients under extremely high pressure. You fire the trigger, and it explodes cereal everywhere. And so we got that, and we used that as a mobile museum, and so took it to street fairs and festivals. And that's really how we got our first step off the ground.
Yeah, well, I remember when the puffing gun came out, and I remember the Kickstarter campaign. So it seemed, you know, I mean, doing a Kickstarter, I've heard mixed things. I think it's harder than people think. But it obviously it launched you off, and I think the whole puffing gun idea or the whole concept is brilliant because it grabs your curiosity as to what is this?
Yeah, and you know I think when people saw the puffing gun, they realized, oh wait, this is not a normal museum, because any other museum would have taken this historical artifact, you know, this machine dates back to the 1930s, and would put it in a glass case, and you'd have a sign next to it. We actually set it up so the thing could work, and you could actually see the magic of how cereal is made, and it's spectacular. You know, it's food literally explodes out of the gun, and kids go crazy to this thing. Anyway, that's the gateway into getting people to think about the more serious stories behind cereal, but you need to have that spoonful of sugar.
Right. So then how did you go about finding your space in Brooklyn, which you're in Williamsburg, you're in a hot neighborhood. Yes, I've never tried to just start a museum. I doubt many of my listeners have, and it probably is a huge process. So how did that go about the actually finding a space?
Yeah, you know, there's just all of these pieces that had to come into place, and that was the work we did between the puffing gun and when we opened in October 2015. You know, you have to get the city supports. We got increasingly we got chefs to sign on and vouch for the museum and help us with our fundraising efforts. People like Questlove came onto our advisory board. Alex Guarnaschelli championed us. You know, Marcus Danielson. All these guys really played an instrumental role in helping us expand our network of supporters. And then we were basically operating as a mobile museum for a couple of years. We did the puffing gun, and then we also did programs and partnered with other organizations to do that. And finally, the funding came together in 2015, and we knew we could actually open up a space. And so I started looking around and just came across this weird, totally unused construction materials warehouse in Williamsburg, and the landlord you know, wasn't generally very interested in renting out that space. He was just sort of using it as a personal, he runs a construction company, and so he was using it to store materials. And, you know, I talked to him, and he was intrigued by what we were doing, and so we worked out a lease and moved in October. And it's really, you know, it's a really great October 2015, and it's really just a great place for the museum to be, because we're on McCarran Park, which is a great family amenity, you know, just a few steps from the pool. There's a skate park. There's a green market right there. And then you have, of course, the really hot foodie culture of Williamsburg, but also, you know, the diverse roots of the neighborhood overall, with a lot of different communities that call it home. And so for us, it's really an ideal place for us to have the first iteration of MOFED.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It is a great location. And I want to hear more about now the different exhibits you're doing and what's been happening. But before we do that, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and talk more with Peter. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Baer. My guest today is Peter Kim, the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn. And we're talking about MOFAD. So I've been to the museum, and I've been to a few of the exhibits you've done, and it's awesome. So let's talk a little about these different exhibitions you've been doing, because you rotate different themes in. Am I correct?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so the space we're in right now, we call it MOFAD Lab because it's best thought of as the test kitchen for the exhibits we want to put into the bigger museum that we're working toward. And so, you know, we've been really strategic about what we do at MOFAD Lab. You know, in a lot of ways, we're creating a museum that just, it's in a category that just hasn't ever really existed. And so there's a lot to figure out. You know, the notion of weaving, tasting, smelling, and eating into a museum exhibition is pretty uncharted territory. And so, you know, and we also, you know, I think part of what we're also trying to do is show people the breadth of topics that a museum of food and drink can take on. You know, going beyond just consumption or just the ingredients and looking at food in a really holistic way. So the opening exhibition we did was on flavor, actually, which I think is appropriate because it's sort of a very primary experience we have with food. And you don't really think about it, right? But there's this crazy chemistry that goes on in your head every time you bite into anything. And, you know, it's because, there's your nose and your tongue are basically chemical detectors, and they're putting together this image based on chemicals that are detected by them. And so that exhibition was about science and technology and physiology and really how... flavor is about, it's almost kind of like best thought of as Legos. You know, you put different Legos together to build flavor. There's an industry that developed around that understanding of flavor called the flavor industry, appropriately enough. And they actually adjust the flavor of all the food that we eat, anything that comes in a package. So we talked about that. And for that, we invented these smell machines.
I remember that. That was fun. When yeah. I was there, just smelling, yeah, it was a cool experience.
Yeah, you know, you press a button, a smell comes out, another button, another smell comes out. You put it all together. You can basically play it like a piano and build 500,000 different flavor combinations using your nose. And so that's exciting to go show people. We also created those Jetson-like flavor pellets that could, you know, through which we gave people tastings of umami. So, you know, if you didn't know what umami was coming in, you definitely learned what it was like and understood it by the time you left the exhibition. Then, you know, because that was such a science and technology-focused exhibition, we wanted to then turn to culture, which is obviously a really important side of food. And so we decided to tell the story of Chinese-American restaurants. That's to say, Chinese takeout places, the places that you see all over the city, all over the country, frankly. And so, you know, for that, that's a story of immigration, identity. It is a crazy history behind Chinese-American restaurants. And, you know, ironically, it started with the U.S. actually trying to kick the Chinese out via the Chinese Exclusion Act, which banned immigration from China for over 60 years. And it led to this, bizarrely led to the development of this cuisine that now is beloved around the country. And so we tell that through artifacts. We have a menu collection. We also have a fortune cookie machine, where, you know, you see cookies being made and you can eat them right off the conveyor belt.
Which is really cool.
Yeah. yeah, kids also love that. I do too, I have to say.
Who doesn't like a good fortune, right?
You know, where we demo culinary technique for visitors. So, you know, again, giving people a multi-sensory experience and taking this very common thing we know of, you know, Chinese-American restaurants, using that to explore really deep questions of identity, immigration policy, what it means to be an American. I don't know if you've had a chance to come through, Shari, but I'd love to show you.
I was there for your opening. Well, I don't know. The launch party of it.
I remember.
Yeah. So that's, I've been there for that. And I mean, I remember the cool, Chinese takeout box, the whole display you have in front with all the little boxes and you had some great chefs involved with that launch party. But yeah, I'd love to come back. So it was a good kickoff.
Yeah, and this was actually one thing that's exciting about this exhibition is it's been a way for us to work directly with chefs on our curatorial content. For the Wok Station, we put out a call to Chinese-American chefs around the country to submit recipes that would highlight different culinary techniques used in the Chinese-American kitchen. And so we got folks like Jeremiah Stone, you know, who has Wild Air and Tantra. We got Lian Wong out in Hawaii. Here in New York, Jonathan Wu and Chris Chung, they all submitted these recipes that were personally meaningful to them that we then create and serve for all visitors who come through the exhibition.
Yeah, no, it was a great, great, great lineup of chefs and people involved. Yeah. And I see on your website and also I've been noticing on Twitter that you have these upcoming programs and workshops that you do. Mm-hmm. Like you've had some things with Hiroko Shimbo and like, tell me about that and how that works.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we have such grand ambitions for the museum. I want to cover everything from digestion to fermentation to, you know, the history of the kitchen to understanding space food, you know, to biodiversity. I mean, I could keep going on and on. But I think sometimes with the space we have, it's always hard that we can only have one exhibition on at a time. And so programs are our way of also being able to show that there's, you know, all the other kinds of topics that MOFAD will touch on. And so, with Hiroko Shimbo, we're doing a program on Japanese pickles. We have Chef Ainat Admoni coming in to do a demo of handmade couscous. And, we also did debates on controversial issues. We did a debate on the future of meat, on GMOs. I think the programs are a great way for us to show that breadth of our approach.
Yeah, that's great. And you have an upcoming spring benefit I saw, too, a dinner. Is that just an annual benefit you do?
Yeah, every year we do a blockbuster event. It's one of our main sources of funding to fund our exhibitions and programs. This is where we really rely a lot on the support we have in the culinary industry. So this year we... One thing I love is, like, when we do our fundraising events, I mean, we can have a lot of fun with it because the food and drink that we serve at the fundraising event is part and parcel of our mission. So we really nerd out. I mean, we've done stuff like recreating an ancient Roman meal, and Mark Ladner got a whole ostrich and cooked it and made this fish sauce, garum, according to an ancient Roman recipe. Dominique Ansel reimagined a tuk tat dong as a MRE, you know, military ration. So this year we're taking on, we're celebrating the current curatorial focus at MOFAD, which is immigrant food cultures. And so we're honoring Ruth Reichel, who obviously did a lot to change people's understanding of how we define American food. And the event's hosted by Gail Simmons, and Alex Guarnaschelli is our culinary chair, and we have some great chefs. We have Marcus Samuelson, Floyd Cardoz, Manish Narotra, and Mina Pizarro. And so I'm super excited, and, you know, it's going to be a really meaningful and delicious event, too.
Awesome. That's coming up on April 13th. Do I have the date right? Okay. Well,
that's
if people want to check it out, I'm sure it's going to be a terrific dinner. And as far as what's next with MOFAD? How far, like how long is the Chinese the Chow exhibition going to go on? And then do you know what's coming next? Is that in the works?
Yeah, you know, so Chow's going to be running through the summer, and this fall we're going to put some new exhibits at MOFAD Lab. But overall, I think were starting to refocus. You know, after we opened the space in October 2015, and you know, the last year and a half has been about really figuring out, getting into our groove, so to speak, of running essentially a small museum. Now I think that we've really figured a lot out of how to make a food museum work at this scale. Now I'm turning my sights back toward expansion. And so the next step for us is opening a museum that is on the order of 30,000 square feet, where we can have multiple exhibitions going on at the same time, you know, world-class programming facilities, a garden where we can highlight biodiversity. This is going to take a serious fundraising effort. And so a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to lay the groundwork and find the champions who want to contribute to the cultural landscape of New York City, because, you know, this is really, I think there's no museum like this in the world, and which is kind of crazy. But on the other hand, you know, I'm really glad, and it might sound a little self-serving, but I am glad that MOFED is the one that is, that we're seizing the mantle here, because we are purists and we are really dedicated to our educational mission. And I think there's a lot of ways you could make a food museum that would be kind of watered down. But for us, we take our role really seriously. So anyway, sorry. So the next step for us is working toward that bigger museum, and using MOFED Lab as a way to show people what that next step could be like.
Got it. And you're looking in New York City to have this larger space?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'm open to a number of different locations, and I'm talking to some developers, but you know, I think Manhattan would be ideal.
We'll take it. Great. So before we take a break, I have a question from my guest on my show last week. I had on Lonnie Sweet. He's the president and CEO of the Connect Group. Uh-huh. And he wants to know, what's your favorite type of food?
Yeah. Let's see. You know, actually, the first thing that comes to mind is, for me, I think the thing that's most satisfying for me is traditional food, and, you know, food that people really identify with. I think wherever I go, whenever I travel, I love just discovering the food that people call their own. And, you know, for me, like right now, we just went into Juarez and, just did a walk through the market with a guy from there. And, you know, it's just so incredible to see people and how proud they are of the food that they make. So I don't know, that's maybe too broad of a category, but that's generally what I look for. But if I had to pick something specific, I think I'm always a sucker for Korean lettuce wraps, and that's sort of my comfort go-to. It's called Sam, and I love it. I love it. I make it for myself all the time.
Yum! I want one right now.
Yeah.
And I get what you're saying. I feel like it's kind of like situational cuisine, I would maybe call it. Like when you're in Texas, you know, you want the tacos or the barbecue, or you know, when you're in Japan, yeah, obviously you want Japanese food. So that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and on that note, we're gonna take another break, and then we're gonna come back and we're gonna play my speed round game and talk some industry news. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Peter Kim, the Executive Director of MOFED, and it's time for my speed round game. So, Peter, what this is I'm going to name a couple things, and you just pick your preference. It's like either-or situation. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat in.
wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Ooh, wine.
Have a tasting menu or a la carte?
Oh, tasting menu.
Small plates or large plates?
Oh, boy. You know, I'm going to say large plates because I like family-style eating.
Okay. Good reason. How about communal table or chef's counter?
Boy, I would say community table.
Okay. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
All-inclusive.
All right, this was a fun one coming up. Puffing gun or fortune cookie machine?
Oh, God, you're making me choose between two of my babies.
I know, maybe I shouldn't have said fun. It was a tough one. I don't know. Do you have a preference?
I'm going to say puffing gun because fortune cookie machine is spectacular, but the puffing gun is something that you just have never seen anything like it, you know? So, yeah, I'll go puffing gun.
Okay. A few more. South by Southwest or any other conference?
Oh, man. Boy, so hard. But, I like a lot of different conferences. Let's go South by Southwest. It's a good time.
Okay, cool. What was the talk you gave at South by Southwest? Interlude.
We did. So I actually did a panel with Pinterest moderating, and it was about food and millennials. And so I did it with a fellow named Oren from Tastemade, and then this lady named Eve, who wrote a book on food and millennials. And we sort of talked about, you know, food hype right now, and is that something, you know, what's causing it, and how long is it going to last, and how do you even, you know, how do you harness it? It was really great.
Cool. I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Okay, two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Cheese plate all the way.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Oh, God, that's hard. I have to say Manhattan.
Okay. I thought you were going to pick Brooklyn because of the museum's location. But I'm all for Manhattan, and even though we're here in Brooklyn, they're not going to be mad at us for our answers.
Well, you know, it's because I live in the East Village, and I have to say I have so much love for that neighborhood. And it's where I've been since I moved to New York. But East Village and Lower East Side, I just really, you know, it's home for me. And so as much as I love Brooklyn, and I spend most of my time actually in Brooklyn, I have to represent for my neighborhood.
Right. Okay. That's great. And that's the game.
Nice.
So, we're going to talk a little industry news. I had an article in the New York Times that came out today by Kim Severson and titled "Chefs Struggle Over Whether to Serve Up Politics." Mm-hmm. And, it's a really good read. Basically talking about how chefs are trying to figure out how much they want to be involved in politics. And I was excited also to talk about this just because in the article she mentioned being down at South Beach Wine and Food Festival. And I saw her there at this panel, Politics Do Belong at the Dinner Table, with Andrew Zimmern and Michelle Nichon. So in the article, she talked about that. And she also had a quote from Stephanie Izzard, and I saw her in having the interview with Stephanie. So I always like when things come to life where I've actually seen them in the making. But it is interesting. She also talked in the article about how the James Beard Foundation has these boot camps on food policy that have become much more popular over the years, and there's a long waiting list of chefs looking to sign up. So what's your take on this?
Oh, yeah. Well, it is a great article, and I have to say it really hit home because it's something we wrestled with quite a bit at the museum when the executive order came out. It's our current curatorial focus, and this happened, you know, we made this decision in December 2015, so, you know, when the primaries were happening. But our current focus is on immigrant contributions to American food culture.
Mm-hmm.
And our current exhibition is about Chinese immigrants who suffered under the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was the U.S.'s attempt to block the Chinese from coming into the country because we viewed them as a threat to the public and also as competition for jobs. So it's really, you know, it hits, you know, when the executive order came out, it really hit home on what we're doing right now. And, you know, I think I'll say off the bat that I think everybody, I don't really subscribe to the notion that, you know, a restaurant is not a political entity. I think we all are, and we always make political statements with everything we do. Even if we don't do anything, that's also a statement. And, you know, at MOFAD, I think for us, actually something in the article that really struck me was the person was saying that, you know, it's this message that used to be very innocuous, you know, immigrants are welcome here. But now feels like this statement that kind of puts you on one side or the other of this line. And, you know, I think that's something we really wrestled with at the museum. You know, I think we certainly all agree at the museum that we celebrate immigrant food cultures, and we view, I mean, you know, we always say when people ask, what is American food? Well, we say, you know, most of it is immigrant food, actually. But, you know, I think for us the counterbalancing thing was, well, you know, we want everybody to feel welcome at the museum. And, you know, if we put up a statement or a sign saying, you know, responding to the executive order, then would that actually deter some people from coming if they felt that it wasn't a place where they belonged or would be welcome? So it's really weird to say, like, well, saying that we welcome everybody could actually make some people not feel welcome. And I think ultimately we decided to take a more oblique tack, let's say, and not make any overt statements like that, because we want everybody to come to the museum. And when you're there and you visit Chow, I think the message of Chow comes through pretty clearly. You know, our role here is, I think, making sure that the story of past times when we did something like this, what happened then, and, you know, it caused a lot of hardship. So, yeah, I don't really have a great direct answer, but, you know, I think everything, we are all political, but it's, you know, it's a hard thing to wrestle with because, yeah, you want to make sure everybody still feels welcome. So, yeah, I don't know.
You know, I think you had a great, great answer. I think the points you made are exactly what this article is talking about, that chefs are, you know, trying to figure out where they want to stand. And then you also have people... You have people like Tom Colicchio, who came on my show a couple of months ago, and he's, you know, helped start Food Policy Action. And I see him on Twitter. He tweets more about politics than anything. Yeah. He's not tweeting about his restaurants really as much. He's using his platform to have a voice. So it's interesting to see what's happening in that. I mean, I think the conversation will be continued.
Yep.
So
and I think there's a legitimate debate to be had here. You know, I think you can take the tack of being very vocal, and I think that's valuable because speaking up certainly is a valuable thing to do. But the other thing you can do is, or you can do something where you try to take a more subtle approach and, you know, do what you can to open people's eyes to the contributions of immigrants and how important they are.
Right.
And I think, yeah, so, but there's a debate to be had, you know, and I think, you know, it's hard because you just really don't want to alienate. I mean, you have to respect the fact that it's nearly half the country that is, you know, behind this. And so, anyway, tough question.
Oh, well, good discussion. So the other article I had, which is sad news, it was on Eater yesterday, how Lucky Peach will likely fold in May. And this was by Amanda Clute. And I think everyone that, you know, I know in the industry is sad about this. Apparently, there were layoffs that happened on Monday, laying off the whole staff, which seems that they're going to have their last issue in May. And this is the 6-year-old indie food media outlet by writer Peter Meehan and restaurateur David Chang, who we all know. And so, I don't know. Not news you want to hear about a Lucky Peach folding. So,
oh, it's such a bummer. I mean, I remember reading the first issue of Lucky Peach and just feeling it was such a refreshing take on food. And honestly, in a lot of ways, you know, I think if I think about, you know, if MOFAD actually ever had a magazine, it actually you know, I think Lucky Peach will certainly be an inspiration for us because, yeah, it just was so great. Yeah. And like, you know, I don't know. As a food nerd, it was a great magazine to read. So.
Yeah, I agree. And we're running a little short on time for the rest of the stuff I had, but I'll just make a little announcement. So Grub Street had an article yesterday on how two of New York's most notable chefs are leaving their restaurants. This was by Sierra Tischgard. And this is Jonathan Benno has announced he's leaving Lincoln after 6 years, and he's going to do his own solo project. And James Kent is leaving the Nomad also to do something solo. So I wish them the best. And the other news, 12 o'clock today, the James Beer Foundation Awards for 2017, they had a live Facebook Live, and they tweeted all the nominees that are for this year's awards. And just a shout out to some of my past guests, Ellie Krieger and Adam Sachs, and were nominated, and Michelle Nishan, he's a Who's Who recipient this year, which is very exciting. And on April 5th, I'm having on Missy Robbins, and she was nominated for Best New York City Chef. So congratulations to them and everyone involved. Stay tuned. April 25th will be the Media Awards in New York City. And then on May 1st, it's the gala in Chicago. And I'm going to be going to the gala, so I'm excited about that. And on that note, one more little break, and then we're going to come back and do my solo dining experience. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Okay, welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. This week, it's at Casa Enrique. Here's the rundown. The location, 548 49th Street, Long Island City, Queens, New York City. The concept, casual cantina serving up refined Mexican classics and cocktails. The chef, Cosme Aguilar. Why did I go? Because this Michelin star restaurant has been on my must check out list for a while. My experience. So I went for an early dinner. I was able to get a seat at the bar right away. Once I got the bartender's attention, I asked for his recommendations and he took my order. While I was eating, I decided to order extra food to go, which was a first for me, but I wanted to try more things. So I ate at the bar, and then I took leftovers home, and I had a bit later and the next day for lunch. So what did I get? I had the guacamole with medium spice, served with homemade totopos, which are chips. I had lengua taqueria, which is two cow tongue tacos, slowly cooked, and the de pollo con mole de piaxtla, which is chicken enchiladas with mole sauce. My take? Great guac, although the ratio of chips to guac was a bit off. I always feel they give you more chips than you have guac, but it was delicious, delicious guacamole. And the tongue tacos were very tasty. I'm not sure I'd had tongue tacos before. And I love the chicken enchiladas. They had a rich mole sauce that was decadent and delightful. So the ambiance is simple decor with a bar and communal table up front and back dining room. Perfect for a Mexican feast with friends. Interesting tidbit. Casa Enrique was awarded one Michelin star in 2015 and has held it since. Personal fun fact. I think I got inspired to take things to go by the man sitting next to me who was waiting for his to-go order. And he told me that the restaurant had stopped doing delivery once they received a Michelin star because they became too busy. So now you have to do pickup. The cost was $40, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes. Their website is henrynyc.com, and that's because the owners have another restaurant called Cafe Henry, and that's Henry with an I. So that's my solo dining. And so now, Peter, it is time for the final question. So my next guest is Randy Weinstein. She's the founder of FAB, a two-day conference for women in the hospitality industry taking place June 11th to 13th in Charleston, South Carolina. So, Peter, what would you like to ask Randy?
This is a little bit of a self-serving question, but I am very curious to know, if Randy could answer the question, what museum exhibition would you like to see that highlights the importance of women in the hospitality industry?
That's a good question. I mean, no, I like it. I will ask. We'll see what she says.
Yeah.
So, and that's the show. So,
this was a lot of fun.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for coming on. Congratulations with everything you've done with MOFAD and what's to come. I look forward to hearing more about it and coming back to the museum. So, and I hope to see you again soon back in New York City.
Yeah, thanks so much, Shari.
My pleasure. So my guest today has been Peter Kim. He's the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Their website is mofad.org. You can find him on social media at Peter MOFAD and at MOFAD. And I'd like to just shout out to MOFAD themselves and Peter for being a great supporter of Heritage Radio Network. We love our collaborations with you. You can find me at Shari Bayer, at Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com and SherryBayer.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks always to my engineer, Vitor. I'm Shari Bayer. I am going to be away next week, so I'm going to be playing a rerun. I think we're going to be doing Tom Colicchio's show, if you want to tune in then. And then I'll be back live on Wednesday, March 29th at 4 p.m. with Randy Weinstein. So have a great week, everyone, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.